So picture this. You're sitting in one of those fluorescent lit conference rooms at work, right? And you're staring at this piece of paper.
Oh, I know exactly where this is going.
Yeah, it's your EQ test score. And it says, I don't know, maybe your self-awareness is great, but your empathy or your social skills are severely lagging. So your manager slides it across the table, gives you the sympathetic nod, and the takeaway is basically, well, there's your personal score. Go work on yourself so you can be a better communicator.
Right. It's treated entirely as this personal diagnostic, like a definitive measurement of your individual emotional capability. Honestly, much like getting your cholesterol checked.
Exactly, and we just accept that. But today, we are unpacking a stack of source materials from a New York-based emotional tech company called 3.2.1 Emotion. And the core of their research proposes this massive paradigm shift.
It really is massive.
What if that entire premise, the idea that emotional intelligence is just a personal score you need to fix, what if that's completely backward? So the mission of our deep dive today is to explore moving away from EQ as this static individual metric.
And instead, treating emotional intelligence, or EI, as a massive shared infrastructure project,
Yeah.
exactly like how we built artificial intelligence.
Right, which requires a radical reframing of, I mean, decades of psychological assumptions.
Totally. Because to understand how deeply entrenched this idea is, we kind of have to look back at how the EQ concept took over the corporate and psychological world in the first place.
Yeah, let's go back to the origin.
So the foundational academic work on emotional intelligence was actually published in 1990 by psychologists Peter Salovey and John D. Mayer, but the cultural explosion, that didn't happen until 1995.
Right, that's when journalist and psychologist Daniel Goleman turned it into a massive bestseller.
Yeah.
He introduced this five-component model, which was self-awareness, self-regulation, motivation, empathy, and social skills.
And Goleman popularized the shorthand EQ emotional quotient. He deliberately mimicked the term IQ because it was just instantly recognizable.
And while that branding choice was brilliant for selling books, the sources argue it actually did a lot of structural damage to how we view human connection.
Because quotient is, by definition, a score.
Yeah.
It ranks individuals on a bell curve.
Yeah.
So the problem with the EQ model is that it treats emotion like height or traditional intelligence, like a static individual metric. It assumes that managing your feelings is a purely solo, private act.
Meaning if a communication fails between two people, the automatic assumption in the corporate world, or even, in couples counseling, is that it failed because somebody's personal score is too low.
Exactly, you failed the test.
Wait, I need to stop you there. Because are we really saying self-regulation is bad?
No, not at all.
Because if I don't take a deep breath before replying to like a passive-aggressive email from my boss, I get fired.
Yeah.
Taking ownership of your own empathy and regulating your reactions, why is measuring that or trying to improve it suddenly a villain?
Yeah, that's a fair question. And nobody is saying self-regulation is a bad thing. Taking that deep breath is crucial. The issue is that the EQ framework is just incomplete.
Incomplete how?
It assumes people are entirely alone with their feelings. It completely ignores the environment, the tools, and the shared vocabulary we operate within. Both things can be true, right? You can work incredibly hard on your individual emotional skills,
Right.
but if the world around you provides no vocabulary, no tools, and no protocols for emotional information to travel cleanly between people, your individual effort just won't rescue the interaction.
Oh, because you're trying to speak a language no one else has the dictionary for.
Precisely. In fact, even Daniel Goleman himself has publicly stated in recent years that he prefers the broader term EI over EQ for this very reason.
Wow. Okay, so to really grasp why treating emotion purely as a personal skill gap is so harmful, the sources point us toward a specific clinical condition,
Yeah.
one that affects roughly 1 in 10 people.
Yes, we need to talk about alexithymia.
Alexithymia. So this is a condition where people are structurally unable to identify or describe their feelings.
Yeah, and what's absolutely fascinating here is how the neuroscience of emotion actually works. Because we tend to think of emotions as starting in the mind, but they don't. They start in the body.
The nervous system produces a physical signal first, right?
Exactly. Your heart rate changes, your stomach drops, your muscle tension shifts. That physical response happens about 100 milliseconds before conscious thought.
100 milliseconds. That's incredibly fast.
It's instant. The brain then reads those physical signals through a biological process called interoception, and it categorizes that data into a concept we call a feeling.
So someone with alexithymia still has all those physical body signals. Mm-hmm. Their heart races, their chest tightens, their palm sweat. But when their brain tries to read the data, there's a disconnect.
Right. They simply lack the internal vocabulary to name what is happening inside them.
And psychologists measure this using something called the TAS-20 scale, which asks questions like whether you're often confused about what emotion you're feeling.
Which you can imagine how frustrating that must be, having the alarm bells going off in your body but having no idea what the alarm is actually for.
It sounds exhausting. So now look at how the old EQ model treats that person. Under the quotient paradigm, a person with alexithymia has a personal deficit.
They essentially fail the emotional intelligence test.
Right. The burden is placed entirely on their shoulders to go to therapy, figure it out, and fix their low score. But under the new EI model, the infrastructure model alexithymia is viewed completely differently.
It's treated as an infrastructural failure. We, as a society, simply never gave them the tools, the mirrors, or the vocabulary to name what is happening inside their own bodies.
It's like telling someone they're a terrible driver, giving them a miserable driving score, and demanding they take more lessons. But when you look outside, we never bothered to pave any roads or build any cars for them to use.
That's a perfect analogy. You can't expect a person to navigate a landscape that simply has no infrastructure. We've spent decades judging the driver without ever looking at the condition of the roads.
Which begs the question, if we haven't been building the roads for emotional intelligence, what exactly have we been building over the last 15 years?
Well, according to the data, we've built a massive digital infrastructure that actually strips emotion away.
And the bill for that specific design choice is coming due.
It really is. It's coming due in the form of a devastating global health crisis. I mean, we live in the most technologically connected era in human history, yet we are facing a structural loneliness epidemic that is terrifying public health officials.
Yeah, the sources cite the 2025 World Health Organization's Commission on Social Connection, which was co-chaired by former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy.
The numbers are staggering. 1 in 6 people worldwide experiences persistent daily loneliness.
1 in 6. That's huge. Mm-hmm. And the mortality statistics attached to that aren't just psychological, they're incredibly physical.
The WHO links chronic loneliness to roughly 871,000 deaths a year globally. The U.S. Surgeon General equates the mortality risks of chronic loneliness to smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
15 cigarettes a day, just from being lonely.
Yes. It's a greater health risk than obesity or physical inactivity, because when you are chronically lonely, your body stays in a constant state of threat.
It triggers persistent inflammation, elevates your cortisol levels,
and fundamentally degrades your immune system over time.
And if you're listening and picturing an isolated elderly person when you hear those stats, you'd be wrong.
Very wrong.
Because the loneliest demographic globally isn't the elderly, it's teenagers. Young people aged 13 to 17 show the highest rates of loneliness across the board.
Which really forces us to look at the mechanism of how this happened. This epidemic is not a sudden collective personal failure of billions of users who just aren't trying hard enough to make friends.
Right.
It is a fundamental design failure of our technology. The platforms that define modern human connection were optimized for attention, swipe volume, and time on app. They were never optimized for empathy or genuine connection.
They measured connection in followers and likes. Mm-hmm. They encouraged us to trade close ties, meaning the 2 to 5 people who actually know you deeply and provide genuine emotional regulation, for weak ties.
Which are essentially just acquaintances and performative followers.
Yeah. So let's look at the primary channel we use to maintain those ties.
Yeah.
Text messaging.
Oh, this is fascinating.
There's a foundational 2005 study by Kruger and colleagues that highlights a massive flaw in how we communicate. They found that plain text strips out roughly 37% of intended emotional meaning.
37%.
Just gone. If you're listening to this and thinking about the last time a simple sounds good text started a fight with your partner because of how it was interpreted, you're experiencing that 37% emotion loss firsthand.
It's a massive overconfidence gap. Senders expect their tone to be read correctly about 88% of the time.
Why so high?
Because when you type a message, you can hear your own tone and sarcasm in your head. But receivers only decode the intended tone correctly about 63% of the time.
That makes so much sense.
Human tone in face-to-face communication relies on voice prosody, facial microexpressions, posture, the pace of speech. All of that biological infrastructure is completely flattened in a text message.
So naturally, the assumption is that if technology got us into this mess, newer, smarter technology can get us out.
Right. The tech industry's favorite solution.
Yeah, exactly. If text messages are flattening our empathy and making us lonely, why not just build AI companions that can talk to us, remember our preferences, and act as our friends or therapists?
It sounds incredibly logical. If you're starving for connection, an AI companion that is available 24/7, never judges you, and always responds perfectly, it should theoretically cure that loneliness.
But the newest longitudinal data completely shatters that assumption. It proves that AI companions are actually a behavioral trap.
Let's really dig into this, because this brand new study flips everything we thought we knew.
Okay, lay it out for us.
Published in Psychological Science in May 2026, researchers Folk and Dunn conducted a massive longitudinal study. They didn't just ask people how they felt after 10 minutes with the chatbot.
Right.
They followed 2,149 adults across four countries over an entire 12-month period.
That is a very robust sample size.
It is, and they found that people who felt more emotionally isolated initially used chatbots more for social purposes. Which makes sense. They were in pain, looking for relief.
Yeah, absolutely.
But 4 months later, that increased chatbot use predicted higher emotional isolation.
Wow. So the relief never actually arrived. The hole just got deeper.
Exactly. The mechanism behind this failure is purely architectural. An AI model can simulate presence and manufacture the appearance of a safe environment, but it cannot be vulnerable. It doesn't have a physical body, it doesn't have mortality, and crucially, it has zero stakes in the relationship.
So it can simulate being received by another mind, but it cannot offer genuine reciprocity.
And real human connection, the kind that lowers your cortisol and cures chronic loneliness, requires vulnerability, reciprocity, presence, and safety. AI companions create what psychologists are now calling parasocial drift.
Parasocial drift. It's like eating junk food when you're starving. A bag of chips stops the immediate hunger pangs, so you feel a temporary sense of relief, but it leaves you completely malnourished.
Yes.
And worse, because you aren't feeling those sharp hunger pangs anymore, you lose the motivation to go to the grocery store, cook a meal, and actually nourish yourself.
That is exactly what parasocial drift is. AI companions provide just enough of a simulation of connection that they relieve the acute, immediate discomfort of loneliness.
But by relieving that discomfort, they crowd out the messy, risky, real human interactions that actually cure loneliness in the long term. You stop reaching out to your friends because the chatbot is easier. But wait, didn't that widely circulated Harvard Business School paper by DeFreitas say AI companions absolutely reduce loneliness?
It did, but we have to look at the methodology. The DeFreitas paper measured short-term loneliness reduction.
Okay.
If I ask you how you feel immediately after venting to a sympathetic AI, you will report feeling better. But the Folk and Dunn study extends that timeline over a full year. Longitudinally, over months, it is empty calories.
You feel connected enough to stop taking social risks, but not connected enough to actually feel held by another human being.
Exactly. You've outsourced the expression of your feelings, and the actual human connection disappears along with it.
Which brings us to the core design principle we're seeing across all these sources from 3.2.1 emotion. Augmentation, never substitution.
That is the defining line.
Right. A tool that helps you find the right word to express yourself extends your human capability. That's augmentation. But an AI that writes the apology message to your partner for you or acts as your pretend romantic partner.
That's substitution. It actively empties the relationship of meaning.
It's the most critical line we have to draw in the next decade of technology. An AI that prepares you for a difficult conversation is an instrument. An AI that replaces the conversation is a substitute.
We've spent billions building artificial intelligence as a shared cognitive infrastructure. Now we have to build emotional intelligence as a shared emotional infrastructure between real people, with AI strictly acting as a supporting component.
Okay, so if substituting humans with AI is a dead end, how do we practically use technology to build this missing emotional infrastructure? How do we build the roads?
Well, 3.2.1 emotion proposes building solutions across four fundamental human gestures: feel, express, understand, and meet.
Let's start with the first two, feeling and expressing. They address this through a radically different messaging format.
Because if we know that plain text strips out 37% of emotional meaning, The solution isn't to just type better.
Right.
The solution is to change the format. So they developed Emo Messenger and a brand new file format, the .emo file.
I find this concept brilliant. Just like a .mp3 file carries sound data, and a .mov file carries video down, the .emo file is designed specifically to carry emotion.
Yeah, it moves us away from flat text and static cartoonish emojis into what they call emotional scenes.
It's a deeply multi-layered file. It includes text, but it integrates Feelmoji.
Yeah.
And these aren't just yellow smiley faces. They are adaptable emotional pixels that carry nuance and intensity.
The file also carries voice snippets and haptic rhythms.
Meaning your phone physically vibrates to a specific pulse that matches the sender's heart rate or emotional intensity.
Exactly. It incorporates screen light flashes and background atmospheres. You don't just scroll past it and read it. You experience it full screen.
And the most mind-bending part is that it's temporal. Time is built into the message.
Which is such a wild concept.
You can send an emotion into tomorrow, or delay it until next Tuesday, or have it unlock on someone's 30th birthday. The timing of the delivery becomes part of the emotional meaning.
It is intentionally built for emotion to travel well, rather than travel fast.
Which directly counters our current notification-driven instant response culture. That culture keeps our nervous systems in a constant state of high reactivity, demanding immediate replies before we've even processed how we feel.
The .emo file gives us permission to pause.
Yeah. Then there's the meet gesture. And this directly targets the teenage and young adult loneliness epidemic, specifically looking at the absolute burnout of modern dating apps.
Because modern dating infrastructure is built almost entirely on the visual swipe, it compresses the massive complexity of human compatibility into a half-second judgment on a two-dimensional photograph.
It's a system optimized for volume and gamification, not the quality of the connection.
Right. And decades of relationship psychology tell us that what actually predicts a lasting, healthy relationship cannot be seen in a selfie.
No. It's about your attachment patterns, how you regulate your anger, and your capacity for repair after a fight.
Exactly. So their product alter emo replaces the visual swipe with something called Emo DNA.
Emo DNA. So this is an evolving emotional signature. The platform builds a dynamic map of how you actually feel, express, regulate, and receive emotion over time based on your interactions.
And then the system matches people by signature against signature. You only reveal your visual identity, your photos, after genuine emotional resonance is revealed.
It's trying to cure what the researchers call mismatch by design. If you build an infrastructure that only measures surface appearance, you will inevitably end up with profound emotional exhaustion.
People go on 100 dates with people who look great on paper but have entirely incompatible ways of handling conflict.
But wait, if we've successfully mapped someone's emotional signature with MODNA, that assumes the person actually knows what they're feeling in the first place.
Mm.
But we just established earlier that 10% of people have alexithymia. They don't have the vocabulary. So how do they participate in this system?
Which brings us perfectly to the final gesture. Understand. And this is where AI comes back into the picture, but strictly as an instrument of augmentation.
Okay.
They've built an AI tool simply called Emo, which acts as a conversational mirror.
The boundary here is vital. Yeah. It is explicitly not a therapist.
No, not at all. It does not diagnose, it does not prescribe, and it doesn't pretend to be your friend. It's an AI trained specifically to help you read your own physical signals and your own Emo DNA.
So if you're feeling that tight chest and racing heart, it helps you name the feeling. It spots patterns in your journaling, helping you figure out what's happening inside your body.
So the AI isn't the destination.
It's the microscope we use to look at our inner life before we take our findings to another human being.
Exactly. It helps that 1 in 10 people with alexithymia find the vocabulary they were never given. It prepares the human conversation instead of replacing it.
That is the ultimate expression of augmentation, never substitution. Mental health and emotional connection, ultimately, are human work. Technology's job should be to make us better equipped to do that human work, not to excuse us from doing it entirely.
I completely agree.
I mean, this has been a massive paradigm shift. If you're absorbing all this, the core takeaway from this stack of sources is incredibly liberating.
It really is.
Emotional intelligence is not a personal test score you need to stress over in a conference room. It's not a quotient that ranks your worth. It is a shared infrastructure that we urgently need to build together.
And we need to build it using tools that preserve the weight and the messiness of our feelings rather than flattening them just for the sake of speed and algorithmic engagement.
We have to recognize that when we feel lonely or when we chronically struggle to communicate with the people we love, it's often a failure of the design of our digital environment.
It's not necessarily a deep personal flaw. We didn't have the roads. But we have the capability to build a better environment now.
Which leaves us with a fascinating and maybe slightly terrifying thought to ponder.
Oh, what's that?
Well, we started this deep dive talking about the muddy waters of human communication, right?
Yeah.
Where text messages lose 37% of their meaning and we constantly misunderstand each other.
Right. We're so used to that ambiguity. We rely on it sometimes.
Exactly. We rely on it. So if we successfully build this infrastructure, if we have tools like EmoDNA that perfectly map how we process feelings, and we have .emo files that flawlessly transmit our exact emotional state with absolutely zero loss in translation.
Yeah.
What happens to the mystery of human relationships if we can no longer blame a miscommunication or a bad text for our relationship problems? Will we finally be forced to face the reality of what we are actually saying to each other?
Wow. When the infrastructure is perfect, there's nowhere left to hide.
There isn't.
That raises an incredibly important question about what we really want from our connections.
It really does. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take a second today to really notice how you're feeling in your body, the actual physical sensations before you send that next text. Until next time.